Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon. We're very glad to have you here for this Meter Center public lecture. This lecture features Professor Alisa Tigelar from the Spanish Department. The lecture is co-sponsored by the Meter Center and the Calvin College Foreign Languages Forum. Alisa obtained her BA from Calvin College in Spanish and Philosophy, and her MA and PhD from Indiana University in Hispanic Literature. She has been teaching at Calvin since 1999. She is the author of several peer-reviewed articles. She has led off-campus semesters, and she has a strong interest in the drama, literature, and thought of early modern Spain. Her presentation for us today is titled Vocation in Teresa of Avila's Reformed Convent Through the Lens of Martin Luther and John Calvin. Please join me in welcoming Professor Tigelar.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming. I'm really looking forward to sharing some thoughts with you and dialoguing thereafter. I'd like to thank you, Karine, for accepting me under the umbrella of the Meter Center. I know I join auspicious people from Calvin and other institutions. Here, I'd like to thank Calvin College for my sabbatical last spring. I wrote this paper on that sabbatical, so I'm thankful for that, too. And also Professor Lee Hardy, who gave me some recommendations for this article in a class that I took with him. You're going to maybe wonder how that happened. I took a class with Lee at the seminary last spring, a class in moral theology, a PhD seminar. And the subtopic thereof was vocation. I thought that particularly appropriate and enjoyed it very much. It was nice to see a colleague teach over the period of a semester. It was nice to make myself be a student again for the sake of my students. And it was certainly nice to study philosophy and theology on a graduate level and not have to drive and be in class. So it was very, very nice. Another interesting facet of that class was the fact that because it was on vocation, I got to meet Teresa of Avila as a Christian woman practicing a vocation. Right? Not as a philosopher, not as a mystical theologian, not as some of those other things, but just as another person exercising her vocation. This image here is the one and only true image of St. Teresa, is what she actually looked like. At least that's what most people say. And I think that we can see in this true image her vocational dedication. We see some imagery of the dove of the Holy Spirit and the banner in Latin, which reads, that she dedicates her life to the Lord. So those aspects are indicative of who she is and her humility. The original title, the title that we have here, as read out by Karine, includes Teresa of Avila's Reformed Convent. And, of course, because it was a title, I got to make Reformed capitalized. We're not talking about our Reformed, but the Catholic Reformation Convent in which she existed. But this isn't the original title. The original title of the paper was Dos Herejes Muy Malvados, Vocation in 16th Century Discalced Carmel Through the Lens of Martin Luther and John Calvin. And this phrase comes from a protege of Teresa named Maria de San Jose Salazar, because Teresa had taught her nuns to articulate themselves in their apostolate against Protestantism. So the two very wicked, evil, horrible heretics are going to be Martin Luther and John Calvin. And my point in saying that is that, you know, that is the milieu that we're in, and so we're very thankful to be looking at things in a little bit of a different lens now, but that just to let you know a little bit of where to start. A bit about Teresa, because I'm going to talk on when I start the formal paper about other things first, but I wondered what you might know about her. At least in my area of studies, most people know that she's a mystic. Okay, the flowering of mysticism in Renaissance Spain within the Catholic Church is not unusual. It comes from medieval practices, is fomented by humanistic practices and that sort of thing. So it's normal, but ecstatic mysticism is something that sounds weird to the contemporary ear if you listen. Bernini, you might know this statue here. Most people say that he took this statue from this phrase, and this comes from the handout. I saw in his hand a long spear of gold, and at the tip there appeared to be a small flame. He appeared to me to be thrusting it once and again into my heart and to pierce my very entrails. When he drew it out, he seemed to draw them out also and to leave me all aflame with a great love for God. The pain was so great that it made me moan, and yet so exceeding was the sweetness of this transcendent pain that I could not desire myself to be rid of it. That is a way that she describes ecstatic mysticism, and certainly it's a bit unusual to the contemporary ear. John W. Donahue says of that, her record of raptures and visions answers to nothing to the experience of most Christians today, right? In other words, there's a distance between that sort of articulation and how we might relate to St. Teresa. We see here an image of transverberation, which you just heard from, that arrow piercing the heart, indicating the presence of God deep within, which is part of mystical nomenclature. Now we move more into imagery that is a little bit more relatable, perhaps. We see her with a quill in hand and a book. These are very common images because she wrote stuff for nuns. She wrote on how to live a life for Christ. And not just mysticism. She understood that that wasn't for everybody, but day-to-day stuff, right? How to help people up, clean up your room, be nice to people, that sort of thing also. So more relatable, perhaps. And here's some more relatable statuary as well. This is one of my favorites. We see her looking up to God. We see her with a quill and the pen and reaching out to help other people. All right, that's what that is. And here, an image of her in her role as pilgrim, founding convents. She founded 16 or 17 convents with St. John of the Cross, whom you might at least be familiar with. And her articulation in the world of her faith is very commonly known in scholarship today, and perhaps indicated in this poem, Christ Has No Body. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's one that's attributed to her and indicates her dedication to work in the world. Christ has no body but yours. No hands, no feet on earth but yours. Yours are the eyes with which he looks compassion onto this world. Yours are the feet with which he walks to do good. Yours are the hands with which he blesses all the world. Yours are the hands. Yours are the feet. Yours are the eyes. Yours are the body. Christ has no body now but yours, no hands, no feet on earth but yours. Yours are the eyes with which he looks compassion on this world. Christ has no body now but yours. So with that beginning, to give us a little bit of a pictorial idea of who this woman is, I'm going to go into the formal aspect of the paper, returning to that class I was talking about. Studying the syllabus of the class that I mentioned, I noticed a potentially challenging point of dialogue with my area of scholarship. The students were to cover Luther and Calvin early on in the semester, including the robust and essential critique of the monastic tradition that their understanding of vocation presents. My research and scholarship centrally concerns female early modern Spanish monastics, and had until then indirectly included defending their choices and labors as truly vocational. And I found myself wanting to re-examine my own perspective through the very lens of what these Protestant reformers deemed essential for vocation. Among more central things, their ideas excluded the monastic option and its central vocational supposition as they understood them from Protestantism altogether. So this is perhaps, as one scholar involved in ecumenical Reformation studies puts it in his own context, the harshest and strangest light possible through which to view 16th century Spanish convent women. The antagonism of the Reforms period suggested in this remark was by no means one-sided. For her part, Teresa of Avila, the Catholic and Counter-Reformation figure considered in this study, viewed opposing Lutheran expansion into Calvinist Catholic Spain as a central aspect of the calling she shared with many other Spaniards. In spite of the undeniable irony of this approach, however, I've experienced considering the life work of Teresa de Jesus and others through a Lutheran Calvinist paradigm of vocation as particularly instructive and fruitful task, one which has challenged some of my assumptions and given me new perspectives and insights. The goal of this talk is to share some aspects of this journey I have taken with the unusual fusion with a group of people who highly value John Calvin's vocational emphases. My final suggestion here is anticipatorily celebrative, perhaps. It is that certain Catholic and Counter-Reformation articulations of Catholic Spanish monasticism might be viewed as particularly vocational, even from a Protestant early modern standpoint. To get to this closing proposition, I briefly discuss early modern Protestantism's oppositional ideas about vocation and monasticism, and consider what historic monastic traditions or tendencies might have contributed to that misunderstanding, and which ones Luther and Calvin carefully admired. We then see how the initiatives of the Theresian Reform in particular might satisfy some Protestant ideals of vocation especially well, even though as Luther and Calvin saw it, other contemporary traditions may have been missing the mark. This will require examining Spain's return to primitive order Carmel, first in the larger context of feminine monasticism, and then from the standpoint of calling as Luther and Calvin articulate it. The particular goal of this analysis will be to contribute to a, quote, more nuanced picture of post-Tridentine monasticism. This tradition, as scholar of early modernity Alison Weber suggests, took, quote, whether consciously or not, many Protestant criticisms to heart and endeavored to revitalize a vocation that had often become spiritual in name only. Excuse me. Of course, post-Tridentine monasticism could not and did not take all Protestant criticisms vis-a-vis vocation to heart, and so doing it would have no longer existed. Luther and Calvin's idea of calling, which you all understand quite well, of course, encompasses why the Protestant Reformation forbid monasticism within its institutional ranks. Their disavowal is perhaps most centrally rooted in the Protestant theological principle that most contributed to the schism between the two churches. Humans are saved by grace through faith alone. By this understanding, human efforts have no saving power, and thus the intercessory vocational work of priests, monks, and nuns, and others towards the sanctification of ordinary people loses its fundamental meaning. As we also well know, under the Protestant understanding, works are to issue forth out of gratitude for salvation and concretely in love shown towards the neighbor. Under this equalizing and communal conception of the association of human relationships and work to one's faith, all that is mundane is thus spiritualized upon doctrinal impulse. The distinction from the sacred, promoted at least indirectly by the Catholic doctrinal notion of a more causal relationship between one's works and one's faith and salvation, is lost. All of this says quite a lot, indeed. So we give individual consideration to the central Protestant Reformation ideas of vocation that bear the most relevance to this study on monastics, and brief mention of some general criticisms of Catholic spirituals that they imply. Most central, again, is the theological legitimacy, that's a Douglas Sherman phrase, aspect, which promotes, as philosopher Charles Taylor puts it, the integral sanctification of ordinary life, end quote, and differs from early modern Catholic understandings in ways noted above. Second, since his conception promotes altering traditional Catholic hierarchies, vocation, once the province of the spirituals alone, is redefined to include any work or human relational activity that contributes to the common good. For this reason, far from promoting sacred roles as the only means of understanding vocation, it eschews the contemplative or monastic way of life, which in this regard often promotes indolence, according to Calvin. Martin Luther states it thus, "Turning the works from itself, faith directs them in love to others, but those blind masters, contemplative monastics, snatch them from their neighbors and transfer them to themselves, thus suffocating and extinguishing both love and faith. They lead man only to love himself and to strive only for his own salvation, which is of no use to anyone," end quote. A third key principle related to the second is that of situationally relevant obedience, a discipleship which, in the words of modern Protestant theologian Karl Barth, must become history and therefore is, quote, already leaping. This idea is illustrated by Calvin in a sermon this way, for example, "For as God bestows any ability or gift upon any of us, he binds us to such as have need of us, therefore making us responsible for use of that talent at a given time and in a given place." This quote, as I emphasize it, suggests a fourth main point, namely that vocation does not exist at all apart from our relationship to God, but rather helps to define it. Prominent Luther scholar Gustav Wingeren puts it like this, "As soon as vocation is abandoned, God loses his hold of man. Both faith and love cease. But through vocations, God's presence is really with man." Elsewhere, he notes that vocation's work is as divine love's coming down to earth, the same self-sacrificial love as was in Christ. Luther and Calvin would dispute monastics' ability to truly achieve these last two points in a vital fashion this way. For Luther, monasticism misses the changeable element of historical and minute-by-minute relevance, engaging what Barth might deem an idle gaping. since some monks remove themselves geographically and circumstantially from the world. As to the final point, the Protestant reformers held that monastic, and particularly contemplative or ascetic practices, advocate an incorrect bond before God vis-a-vis action, both in terms of the relationship to God that might be suggested and the activity that could be promoted. Interpreting Luther, Wingeren notes that Christ is not to be imitated by us through meaningless rituals, for example, but rather accepted in faith, because Christ also has his special office for the salvation of man, which no one else has. To summarize the above by means of transition, for Luther and Calvin, vocation spiritualizes all activity and relationships as a matter of theological rectitude and must include these interrelated things: promotion of the common good, situationally relevant obedience, and a theologically correct stance regarding our relationship with God and neighbor that issues in action. According to these reformers, most monastics of their time appear to neglect these principles for the reasons listed and others too complex to discuss here. However, even Luther, seemingly more stridently opposed to monastic orders than Calvin, asserts in a sermon that monks and nuns should be free to choose these offices of their own conscience, for if they are forbidden, the forbidding is wrong, since it is contrary to God's ordinance, although he qualifies elsewhere that, quote, lifelong poverty, obedience, and chastity may be observed, but cannot be vowed, taught, or imposed. In his 1990 book on Christian vocation, philosopher Lee Hardy picks up incisively on the issue of Luther and Calvin's position, reminding us that their disapproval was related more to the dynamics of monasticism in the crippled 16th century church than to the calling itself. Hardy recalls Luther's caveats, which seem largely based on doctrinal disagreements, calling into question less the what than the why and the how of the monastic commitment. Quote, first, the vows are not to be taken as a way to righteousness or to make satisfaction for sin. Instead, they are, quote, to be taken up in a spirit of freedom, not as a higher law for the achievement of spiritual perfection in this life and like any other vocation, end quote. Hardy additionally points out that Calvin's position on monasticism in particular was tempered by the Frenchman's fonder view of its former practice. Quote, since the earlier rule was an instrument rather than a standard of piety, end quote. Theologian Matthew Meyer Bolton picks up on the same emphasis in a recent study. He goes so far as to say that Calvin grounds his quarrel with monasticism in an endorsement of it, noting that, quote, while Calvin's chief interpreters have by and large elected to emphasize the disjunctions, that striking parallels also exist, unquote. Parallels which speak to the arguable influence of some aspects of monasticism on Calvin. Indeed, in much the same fashion as Counter-Reformation Catholics took the reproach of heretics to heart, as mentioned earlier, the Protestant notion of vocation might have been shaped, quote, by the same activities that fueled the better parts of monastic Christian service. This is what Jason Hood notes in a blog at the Society for the Advancement of Ecclesial Theology website. To be sure, some of the laudable aspects to which Hood alludes resonate well with the key attributes of Protestant vocation as we discuss them here. We begin with love of fellows, a vital concern for Calvin. Speaking of third century monasticism, historical theologian J. Warren Smith asserts that the ascetic life is nothing more than learning to love as God loves, and the disciplines of the monk, example fasting, selling off possessions, foregoing sleep, living in the desert, are not the heroic pursuit of virtue for its own sake and for one's own glorification, but the means for learning how to love God and neighbor rightly. Smith cites Rowan Williams, the current Archbishop of Canterbury, who views monasticism as, quote, the actual business of living the body of Christ, loving in concrete community. According to Bolton, ancient monasticism provided, quote, an immersive path of practical formation, end quote, and gave service to the wider church community through the preaching of a rule of piety that was available to all. In ancient monks, piety was typical and accessible, not extraordinary, says Bolton. Additionally, some monastic practice clearly served as an example of immediately relating all relationships and activities to one's spiritual walk in a similar way to that recommended by Luther and Calvin. On this point, the above speaks to monastic emphasis, the comprehensive nature of loving God through the brother over self-glorifying action, or perhaps overworking with an emphasis on one's own eternal reward. This love must include shared chores, for example, as Saint Benedict famously insisted. Along these lines, Jean Leclerc, a monk and scholar of the Benedictine order, reminds us that much of monastic theology was based on the following premise. Quote, in the cloister, theology is studied in relation to monastic experience. The realities of faith, a certain lived faith, is at one and the same time a condition for and the result of monastic theology, which at every level remains an act of faith. End quote. He further exclaims that the personal experience of recognition in a deep and living manner by means of prayer and the Lectio Divina of Mysteries is linked with the whole environment. This gives us reason to believe that these exemplary benefits are not related only to the active or publicly apostolic aspects of monasticism, but to the recollected or contemplative ones as well. Even so, Benedict's rule, which influenced much of the monasticism that followed it, emphasized the role of common work to both community outreach and the prayer life. Work had to punctuate prayer, and life had to have communal order. Likewise, as Stephen Nichols points out, medieval Cistercian Bernard of Clairvaux fully endorses reflecting on and contemplating the love of God. But he's careful to lodge that reflection in the concrete revelation of God, first and foremost in his word, then in the world, and then in experience. Taken as a whole, the above might illustrate what many consider to be Calvin's core comprehensive requirement for quote-unquote holy and lawful monasticism. The lifestyle and its aims should function as a channel rather than dogmatically. Bolton quotes the same idea from Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. Augustine, says the reformer favorably, requires a kind of monasticism which is but an exercise and aid to those duties of piety enjoined upon all Christians. The duties are, as we saw them above, the linchpins of true vocation, love of God and neighbor, and correct or rightful recognition of that love in and through all types of activity. But where exactly are we to see that love articulated? We have affirmed through Bolton that it extends at least to the larger community and healthy monastic context. Leclerc suggests that it must extend further. He says, theology, spirituality, cultural history. These three realities were not separated in the real life of the monks, and they can never be dissociated. He means, I think, in his own context, that cultural currents link one monastic community to others throughout the centuries. But since these communities in turn influence their wider ones over time, we might heartily agree with philosopher James K.A. Smith, who posits a key use for weaned worldly affections, quote, monastic abstention for cultural labor. In this regard, Smith also references Calvin's admiration for Augustine, for whom monasticism, quote, was very much a cultural project. It did not constitute withdrawal from economics, politics, and concern for work. Other thinkers have noted, A, how monastics have historically advanced valuable cultural ideas within their own ranks, B, how they have contributed to the wider cultures in which they have lived, and C, with Leclerc, how they have both responded to and advanced cultural in general. Ivan J. Kaufman, co-founder of the Mennonite Catholic Dialogue Bridgefolk, notes on all three points that monastics, quote, were people who converted the pagan inhabitants of Europe to Christianity. They were the people who copied the scriptures and kept the learning of the past alive. They were the people who founded schools and hospitals. And they were the people who introduced the basic principles of democracy by electing their own leaders. They were the people who made manual labor respectable by including it in their daily lives, end quote. The issue of the extent to which vocation responds to, engages with, and even changes culture or social structures is the main point on which Luther and Calvin show their generational differences, and hence a good point with which to conclude this portion of the study. Discussing the Calvinist distinctive in part as elaboration and in part modification, Hardy indicates that for the younger reformer, in the latter case, the station is no longer itself normative, that's a quote, as it was for Luther. Instead, one must advocate from within one's own calling for cultural change through, in the words of Ernst Troeltsch, the free use of vocational work as the method of realizing the purpose of the holy community. It seems potentially defensible, then, that at least in one regard, some monastics may have inherently supported Calvin's advanced Protestant understanding of vocation more so than the reformer who is most associated with its early articulation, meaning Luther. With the last portion of this paper, I attempt to represent this very idea through the analysis of the vocation of an extraordinary group of Spanish monastics. Finally, the female Catholic Reformation discuss Carmelites most closely associated with the Theresian reform to the primitive rule of this order. We will also look at the other ways in which this group of nuns may have merited the admiration of John Calvin as much as the monastics we know him to have respected, in spite of having lived in a context that makes this seem impossible, unlikely, something. It is to that context that we first turn to provide a frame of reference for further discussion. Yep, great slide. These exceptional Carmelites, as we recognize, flourished in a complex milieu that was distinctly opposed to the Protestant Reformation. In the 16th century, Spain was the most powerful empire of the early modern Western world and determined to remain absolutely Catholic. Taking advantage of their global power, the reigning Spanish monarchs of the era, Charles I and Philip II, pursued domestic and international measures to stem the tide of the Protestant reforms through both political and religious legislation and warfare. Lutheranismo did exist in Spain, but largely successful measures were put in place to quell it in 1523 and following. The methods that the Church employed through the Council of Trent to ensure, supposedly, that monasticism survived in the face of Protestant attacks were enforced in Spain with special fervor through inquisitional presence. And Trent's central demand for monastics of strict enclosure for women, among other things, certainly makes drawing parallels between Spanish female monastics and the Protestant concept of vocation seem at first glance like a rather futile task. How could monastic practices under a new regimen that in some concrete ways limited the range of a nun's social influence and at times codified their schedules and behaviors unto uniformity possibly suit the new Protestant understanding of vocation? Furthermore, the spiritual authorities in Spain, ever fearful of the spread of Lutheranism or anything that looked like it, seemed to favor a reversal of the vocational movement of spirituality into the world that Luther and Calvin also promoted, and put an end to it where they could. In the words of Max Weber, the official Catholic Church treated the innerworldly asceticism of laymen with extreme suspicion and tried to direct it into the path of formation of orders, in other words, to take it out of the world. And Spain during the 16th century was a stellar example of that. No, the general environment does not seem terribly ideal, nor do the general monastic restrictions bode well. Indeed, scholarship has made clear that some of the ideologies, physical limitations, oppressive oversight, and so on, that were imposed upon Spanish nuns and other Counter-Reformation women resulted in significant limitations even for the times. For example, it had been more common in the pre-Counter-Reform Renaissance for Spanish women to be educated and read devotional literature and theological works with vernacular biblical text. Beatas, who had previously preached in public and had large followings, by this time had fallen under great suspicion. In addition to absolute enclosure, convent women faced greater negative attention than before from inquisitional authorities for certain behaviors and writings. All of this said, however, as contemporary scholar Milagros Ortega Costa asserts, although the Catholic Reformation resulted in undeniable limitations for lay and religious Spanish women, it also permitted them some continued limited autonomy, most particularly within convent walls. Ortega's argument, while seemingly contradictory, makes sense when considered in light of the continued positive aspects of convent life and the arguably adverse realities of 16th century Protestant alternatives for women. After all, convents throughout history had long provided women with unique opportunities, and many of them continued unabated. To name but a few examples, female monasteries had long provided socially viable option for women who did not wish or could not marry to attain some sort of social and economic independence from male relatives. The monastic life had allowed women to exercise true religious vocation and make worthy contributions both inside and later outside convent environs. And some convents gave women a refuge from poverty and other types of social exclusion. From the 12th century onward, Europe saw a proliferation of charitable monastic institutions specifically intended to shelter vulnerable women who had experienced poverty, family disintegration, and violence. Abandoned wives, battered women, widows, ex-prostitutes, or women in danger of losing their honor and good reputation. And in Teresa Avila's case, we might add women with physical deformities, the wrong sort of intellect, mental challenges, and on and on. Moreover, some scholars argue that the Protestant Reformation's vocational imperative of marriage and elimination of the convent option was particularly limiting for women. Scholar Susan C. Carrant Nunn and Mary E. Wisner Hanks note that, quote, reciprocal love between the spouses did not mean equality, and Luther did not believe in this. The wife was and had to be the husband's helpmeet and subordinate. Luther was certain that women were not called to preach, teach, and govern, but to bear fruit. Beverly W. Harrison argues along the same lines that, quote, the reformers closed down women's religious houses, destroying the one clear institutional base of women's culture. The overall point seems to be that while Protestant Reformation served as a necessarily democratizing gesture for men by opening up the designation of vocation to all social roles, it was in both private and public senses arguably restrictive for some women. The role of wife did not substantially change, and institutional opportunities were also diminished, according to some. At least a few scholars argue that early modern women were aware at some level that monastic prohibition was a particularly gendered disadvantage. In Nuns, A History of Convent Life, 1450 to 1700, Sylvia Evangelisti notes that nuns fought harder than men to defend their institutions, and that exceptionally, convents with won Protestant women over to the popish cause, particularly explaining this interesting phenomenon thus. Whilst former priest monks and friars might obtain ecclesiastical promotion and become pastors in the new Protestant church, no such option was available to women who had no institutional role in it and whose only option was to go back to family life. Indeed, many nuns were forced into unwanted or happy marriages, and those who didn't find a mate often lived in particular penury, according to Evangelisti. It appears, then, that in the final analysis, it is as plausible and defensible for women in general as for the men discussed earlier in this study that the convent provided a unique location in which spirituals could articulate a true sense of vocation and live fulfilled lives. It also seems that nuns were aware of this and fighting for it when, for example, they wielded pitchforks and other homely weapons against Protestant invaders in 1520s Germany. Just saying. Most astonishingly, it is possible that even Martin Luther himself recognized that the convent was an especially viable vocational option for some women if undertaken correctly. Caveats. Marriage is also a calling and must be vocational. In 16th century Germany, Protestant convents existed, inhabited by Lutheran abbesses and nuns. As Evangelisti notes, very interestingly, a few Protestant convents flourished, like the Canis's House of Quedlinburg, which became Protestant in the 1540s, was turned into an elementary school, and managed to retain papal privileges somehow. Yeah, I thought so too. I had no idea, you guys. All other cases aside, however, it is certainly true that convent life was well defended in Counter-Reformation Spain, and not just by the authorities previously discussed who imposed strict enclosure and other undeniable limitations upon spiritual women for their own reasons. In fact, it should now come as no surprise that many Spanish nuns themselves defended monastic orders with increased enthusiasm, not merely in reaction to Protestant attack or in strict agreement with what at least in part amounted to male control, but out of what was clearly a genuine and vocationally oriented reforming spirit of their own. St. Teresa of Avila, arguably the main monastic reformer in Spain and founder of the Discalced Carmelites in 1562, is one of the clearest cases of this. And so with this, we turn to a remarkable renewal of female cloistered life through the seemingly, perhaps less perverse now, lens of Protestant vocational ideology. Here she is. In spite of many generally positive aspects of monastic life that were never entirely lost to Spanish monasticism, Madre Teresa de Jesus became convinced that the Spanish convent tradition as it stood in the 16th century was in need of some substantial changes. There were many smaller contingent problems to address as well. While she was not ignorant of the value of an active female apostolate, having lived one out personally in a limited fashion until she was in her early 40s, the founding mother considered that in general, life within monastic cloistered convents in Spain at that time presented three main problems. One, it followed worldly principles rather than those of God. Two, it encouraged false vows or vocation, and it discouraged the contemplative way of life. Teresa saw that the frequent interaction with society that open convents engendered had largely become a deficit, since nuns were increasingly beholden to catering to the vainer interests of their patrons, and sometimes promoting the elitist familial and political agendas in ways that proved destructive to the monastic community. For example, not infrequently nunneries accepted novices that were not really suited to the calling because of the high dowries that were offered, which were nevertheless more modest than those required for marriage. This pandering to the norms of society over the encouragement of spiritual ones influenced convent life in many ways. Wealthier girls and those of higher social standing sometimes were accepted into the convents ahead of less privileged ones, which in turn promoted patterns of gentrification in the convent. Women of greater worldly status ran the orders as well. More devastatingly, the governing principle of worldly honor, so important to Spanish society, maintained its unwarranted foothold inside the convent walls, warring with spiritual values. Furthermore, because convents were often used by families to unburden themselves of extra daughters, many young women were sent to the cloister without a true vocation for it and never developed this essential gift. Sad stories of disruptive and bitter women have survived that speak to this unfortunate truth. Teresa's surviving letters contain reminders to her prioresses about accepting those with legitimate calling and turning away wealthy but unsuitable candidates. They also contain advice about how to deal with nuns who do not appear to have vocation and details about their unfortunate cases. I could give several anecdotes of these letters. Teresa's advice to prioresses about women who were in trouble in different fashions, women who thought they were mystics but really were, in today's parlance, bipolar, how to deal with these just human cases. She was very caring for every element within the convents that she considered herself mother of, all the way down to do your chores and help this person out and don't be so conceited in those kind of things. It's interesting stuff. Finally, recollection. Perhaps given a lack of spiritual sincerity, the general suspicion of the practice and other factors, non-cloistered convents were not amenable to the sort of discipline and activity that Teresa considered essential to female monastic life and wished to see flourish, contemplative prayer. The reformer considered that to help alleviate these problems in others, strict enclosure was an imperative, and she succeeded in attaining it for a reestablished order some years before Trent mandated it. Indeed, enclosure most likely made the convent choice less appealing to those not truly called. A more controlled environment allowed a hierarchical church to consider granting more governing power to the nuns themselves a safer option, and greater internal power made it easier to mentor the practice of spiritual disciplines and so forth. Additionally, the new enclosed female monastery relaxed authoritarian fear of contemplative activity somewhat, since the hermetic environment of the practicing nuns guaranteed that they would not inappropriately influence the masses with ideals that, according to church officials, belonged to an elite group of believers. More than this, however, enclosure, the leading corrective of Teresa of Avila's chief concerns, promoted the sort of convent environment where vocation could truly flourish along quote-unquote Calvinist lines. To be sure, enclosure meant some significant lifestyle changes for the discalced order. Nuns within the Teresian reform, once they entered the convent environs, could not go out again during their lifetime without special dispensation. They could never be seen by people outside of the convent walls, and visits even from secular women were heavily prescribed. Even so, they led full, even happy lives with their fellows. They were spiritual leaders entre muros and developed their artistic and literary talents. They had and learned to read and did other things. They advised political leaders and male clergy. They ran the convents on their own, each one taking her turn with menial tasks. They rested and recreated together, and they prayed. The Carmelite schedule left room for all of this. Although the nuns spent the majority of their day in contemplative and some liturgical prayer, they spent almost as much time in physical labor. Meals were silent, but the day provided at least 2 hours of conversation and mutual learning, which Teresa insisted be joyful. In a certain sense, however, what this intentional and watchful Christian community shared with the Calvinists more than anything was a likeness in spirit. The nuns saw the interconnectedness of the people and the stuff of life rather than hierarchies, and they insisted on the centrality of love of neighbor through all of these interrelated activities as essential to faith. In the Teresian community, members were encouraged to love their fellow nuns in work, rest, and recreation, and prayer. Studying Teresian literature, and you have the Spanish on those little handouts if you want. Okay, this is English. Studying Teresian literature, we see that such opportunities are viewed as the way to love God also. For example, in discussing amore spiritual, or spiritual love, and some ways to experience it in the way of perfection, Teresa recommends the ancient rule emphasis of helping others with menial tasks and appreciating the spiritual growth gained from sharing work. She says, one, it is also a good sign of spiritual love to try to take on the labors of a fellow yourself as far as housework is concerned, and also to delight and praise God because of the growth you see in her virtue. So dusting in virtue, but yeah. Spiritual love is expressed through communal means, according to Teresa, also in times of rest, which are not to be curtailed since they are important unto this end. Also, quote two, make an effort to have fun with the sisters during recreation as they need it and use the full period. After all, everything is perfect love, so it is a good thing to consider the needs of others. Finally, prayer offers an opportunity to love the neighbor and community. Of course, there were the chanted ritualistic prayers that were offered as petitions for specific individuals and so on. But as Jody Billingcoff points out, going back to the primitive rule meant that, quote, in a departure from other monastic tradition, Teresa stressed interior mental prayer as opposed to chanted vocal prayer, and the vast majority of time dedicated to prayer was spent in silent worship. Billingcoff also reminds us that, quote, this powerful contemplative practice, correctly implemented, made for a genuine dialogue with God, unquote. This dialogue, in turn, infused the rest of the day's activities and issued in acts of charity, as we see, for example, in Teresa's Meditations, quote three. When the soul is in this state of awareness through contemplative prayer, may Mary and Martha never cease to work almost as one. Because in active things, and that which appears exterior, interior things are at work. And when active works shoot forth from such a root, they are admirable and sweet-smelling flowers. Teresa's point here also illustrates another related principle that Protestant Reformation theologians applied to their concept of vocation, the necessary interrelatedness of all human activity with emphasis on the quote-unquote non-holy aspects of life, must take spiritual meaning or value. Interestingly enough, Teresa, a mystical practitioner, learned this over time through her raptures. Edward Howells discusses Teresa's learning curve in a 2002 study. He describes her eventual realization, expressed in its maturity in the above reference from Meditations, this way. Mystical knowing is therefore what we might call an intersubjective state between the soul and God. The soul is able to objectify this state without turning God into the object of knowing in the ordinary sense, because the soul relates to God. Inasmuch by grace the soul is made capable of God and turned towards God to see and love as he sees and loves himself. The seeing and loving of the soul remains its subjective prerogative, but now the soul sees and loves through God. Thus the mystical knowing and ordinary knowing become a single act, as ordinary knowing is deepened into intersubjective knowing and loving with God, through which God and objects of the world are known. Howells further outlines Teresa's growth in her view on the relationship between mystical union or prayer and the everyday, summarizing that there is more concern for how communal love becomes part of union with God as she develops a Christological relation between the interior and exterior dimensions. Enriched in her understanding of the relationship of the spiritual and the mundane, Teresa became less willing to privilege in her didactic writings a mystical union which ethereally engulfed the subject, and more ready to embrace a prayer state in which Mary and Martha coexist. Howells, quoting Teresa, puts it thus, both kinds of union are compatible. The new union is added to others a high estate. It involves a rejection of raptures in favor of active works. It is a cross because it requires souls to give up their special delight and satisfaction in rapture in favor of working for the benefit of the neighbor and nothing else. This, shares Howells, is actually a progress forward in Teresa's mystical theology. The purpose of the true union is to introduce a corrective to her old view, which left little room for the human activity of the soul in union. Under her new view, the soul attains Christ in its active work and in dying is transformed into Christ. Therefore, as McNamara points out, Joanne, Carmelite sisters were advised to spend time saved by their efficient completion of a task in helping one another rather than engaging in extra prayer. In fact, Teresa's epistolary work attests also to her concern for the mundane. Many of almost 500 surviving letters discuss issues such as literacy, medical practices, the politics and economy of monastic reform, disciplinary and health issues, the physical concerns of founding monasteries, and on and on. Teresa herself viewed her recognition of the necessary interrelationship of the contemplative and the active life both as part of her spiritual maturation and as a special gift from God, perhaps in no small part because it revitalized her understanding of her apostolate. The intimate connection between contemplation and the active life through intersubjective knowing and loving with God also meant that prayer was, for her, intimately related to mundane affairs, and in a certain sense, prayer therefore was meaningful activity in the world, since the two could not be separated. Inasmuch as Teresa of Avila brought prayer or contemplation into her daily routines, she brought worldly affairs to her prayer life. Therefore, although she insisted on cloistering in her return to the primitive order of Carmel, this did not mean that she cut herself off from an active apostolate in every sense. Indeed, prayer was for the reformer and her disciples a rigorous act of spiritual labor. As Weber asserts, Teresa and her followers believed that through a life of intense prayer, requiring practices that could only be carried out through withdrawal from the world, women religious could contribute to the defense of Roman Catholicism imperiled by war and schism, and thus fulfill an important aspect of the Church's ecclesial mission as laid out by Trent. In Way of Perfection, Teresa speaks to the mission thus, quote 4, "My only desire was and still is to see the success of the Lord's followers." An ironic in the context of this study, of course, reference to supplicatory participation in the battle against Protestantism. Así fue. Although Teresa and her followers ostensibly adhere to the dictates of the hierarchical church in their cloistered apostolate in many other regards, two final ways in which their lived faith bore resemblance to Calvinist vocation show that churchy obedience, strictly speaking, was perhaps or even likely not a primary motivator. First, Teresa preached situationally relevant and biblically motivated obedience, Karl Barth's Already Leaping. Second, in some important cases, she and her disciple sisters championed and even spearheaded initiatives that challenged societal and church structures. As Maria Pilar Manero Sorolla emphasizes, the presence of the Bible was particularly strong in Spanish spirituality, and in particular in Carmelite spirituality. In spite of increased caution around scripture-centric teaching in the convent, Teresa still advocated for biblical obedience over institutional rules or preferences where appropriate, and specifically in times of great need. As Billinghoff asserts, Teresa's, quote, "own direct mystical experiences of God left her convinced that he selected the workers he wanted, regardless of their sex, and compelled them into the service of his choice." Sometimes this obedience involved cloistered apostolic work for which the reformer fervently solicits God's help. Quote 5, "that God make me worthy to do something to win over souls to his service, and that my prayer would be effective since I was unable to do anything else." Other times, Teresa's work, potentially less sanctioned by more conservative church authorities, seemed to receive its legitimacy directly from God. In one case, speaking of founding convents, she says, "I didn't go looking for this role. First, I thought it was foolishness. But love for pleasing the Lord and faith make it possible that which human reason cannot." The suggestion here may be that the faulty natural faculties, the human reason cannot, belong to authorities. Her reference is unclear. Maybe it's hers. Teresa legitimates her founding activity in a portion of her Way of Perfection that was tellingly even censored for a time. Quote, "in times like these, it does not make any sense to waste virtuous and strong souls, even if they belong to women." There you are. Bye-bye. These times, of course, refer to the Counter-Reformation Church's battle against Protestantism. She even breaks from her own preference for enclosure, now instituted by the church, because of, quote, "the news of the harm done in France and the havoc wreaked by those Lutherans, and how much that wretched sect was drawing. It exhausts me." It's her, not me. Indeed, as the accounts of Teresian apostles also make clear, the spiritual battle against what they regarded as heresy was central to their contemplative mission. The fact that Teresa founded a good number of female and male monasteries may help held up as an example not only of what was for her historically relevant obedience, but also of her involvement in initiatives that arguably challenged, renewed, or advanced social structures. As we have already mentioned, the Discalced Carmelite group directly defied a social order based on blood purity and honor, instituting instead a different, more egalitarian hierarchy in which women were spiritual equals and elections for comment roles were to some extent democratic. They directly challenged the church, too, by unlinking authoritarian constitutions from the will of God in certain cases, as we have also seen. Teresa's movement challenged Spain's institutions in many more ways. For many spiritual and political reasons, the time-honored Celts Carmelites viewed the Discalced with suspicion, often impeding their growth in cities where the Celts' presence was particularly strong. In fact, Teresa and those who sympathized with her were brought before the Inquisition by this group and others who suspected their movement in part because it championed some of the same spiritual practices that the Protestants endorsed. A closer and more reciprocal relationship with clergy and in confessors that were sincerely vocationally equipped, personal devotion and familiarity with the Bible, to name a few. Another challenge to institutional norms was the increased authority granted prioresses in the Teresian order. Discalced prioresses had greater autonomy than before from their male confessors, and the power to select and change their confessors and preachers for individual convents. They also maintained important roles in directing the spiritual lives of sisters and coordinated the financial administration, discipline, and selection of novices within their convents. Additionally, they served as spiritual examples by participating in menial duties and using the talents that God had given them as individuals, recalling the gifts-based understanding discussed earlier. Some, like Teresa, were mystics and used that ability meaningfully. Others, such as Maria de San Jose Thalassar, were not, but used their gifts as well, too. For example, Maria, having a flair for leadership and administration, founded the first international Discalced institution. Finally, these primitive order Carmelites participated in the creation of advancement of what they considered to be laudable social structures by founding New World convents. As Evangelisti notes, these institutions played an important and defining social role in New Spain in that they drew different groups of women into community, educating and housing them, for example. Christopher C. Wilson adds this: through prayer, dispensation of spiritual advice, acceptance of novices, and the placement of churches beside their convents, female monastic communities played a key role in cultivating a relatively young American church. All in all, when we see the faith-driven interconnectedness of the mundane and the spiritual that Teresa de Jesus espouses, along with the centrality of love of the neighbor and world-aware obedience, and to extent gifts-based influence over social structures of the Carmelite way of life, it appears that Calvinist definition of vocation is not only merely suitable, but singularly and even revealingly appropriate. Indeed, it may be that viewing Teresa's singular efforts and influence in the vocational terms of Martin Luther and John Calvin helps us see anew the power and range of the founding mother's spiritual influence over those who were touched by her example. Certainly, it has been shown in many excellent studies that Teresa's vision, expressed in her life and many writings, influenced her disciples at home and in Spain, abroad into the New World in her lifetime, and extended to the next generation. But the Calvinist vision, much as it would have horrified and offended Teresa de Jesus as such, seems to be a particularly appropriate to illustrate her influence in even wider-ranging terms. For as much influence as the first Carmelita Descalza doubtlessly had on establishing and maintaining the 16th-century schism, perhaps her example and influence also contributed in some way to the beginnings of ecumenical dialogue around, for example, the very issue of vocation. This ecumenism is, of course, so clearly evidenced in more recent Catholic understandings and attitudes towards the relationship of faith and work, such as the one put forward in Dr. James Martin S.J.'s The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, sounding much, like Neil Plantinga in Engaging God's World. Martin quotes another Jesuit, Chris Launey, and also speaks for himself like this. What about vocation? People tend to associate vocation with a specific work, job, or career, Chris said. The Protestant reformers talked about a general calling to become holy people and a specific calling to different kinds of ministries and work, which is more accurate. Vocation overarches our work, jobs, and career and extends to the kind of person we hope to become. It is what we are called to do and who we are called to be," end quote. It seems by way of conclusion that in this, Martin is showing ways in which Protestant and Catholic Christians can learn from each other by looking in on much that we have in common in rich, interesting, rigorous, and mutually challenging ways that determinedly learn from rather than avoid difficult history. It is this sort of work that I have heard through the work of others through the Meter Center lectures and hope to have contributed in some small way to today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much. We'll have a time of questions.
Yes.
So yes, you don't want to disappear. I'd like to start out with a question if I can. Clearly, although Teresa was operating within her convent world, a lot of what she said about vocation was challenging to some of the church leaders of her day. Can you say anything specific about any responses they gave that tie into vocation? I mean, they might not have liked a lot of things that she was doing, but was there anyone who said, you know, your understanding of vocation is off and it should be this, not that?
That's a very good question, one that I haven't necessarily thought long on. Teresa was very careful to advocate for monastic correctness. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, mm-hmm. she allied herself with what the rules of the time were, and she played ball according to those rules. Mm-hmm. You know, she was brought before the Inquisition on a number of occasions because she was doing stuff that became, you know, very suspect in a certain way. Mysticism, which had before been considered even normal and spiritually appropriate because it was a relationship of the believer with God on an individual level, when Protestantism comes along, it becomes suspect. You know, just like Erasmus became suspect. You probably know all about that. And so she was very careful to align herself within the convent traditions. Mm-hmm. And so no one ever said to her, well, your ideas on vocation are really off, mm-hmm. because she contributed them within a very specific structure and was very careful to articulate herself in line with church policy. And when she didn't, they scratched it out, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When she carefully asserted something a little bit more forward-thinking, mm-hmm. it would disappear and she would back off. Does that kind of sort of answer your question? Okay. There's a lot I could say.
Yes. Other questions?
Or comments or
feedback. Yes.
Or your own ideas.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you find specific research or people talking about this idea of the empowerment of women sort of in the tick-up to the Reformation, but then the disempowerment of women in the destruction of the convents?
You know, people talk about that, and I mentioned it, I think, in a phrase. I was unable to go on much further about that, that in the earlier Renaissance, women had a little bit more autonomy. There was a forward-thinking idea that they could read devotional literature, that there even existed Bibles in the vernacular and that sort of thing, that kind of got clamped down upon when the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and the Catholic Reformation came along. But I think your question was a little bit more broad range than that. Could you maybe rearticulate it?
Yeah, I just was wondering, are there people writing about that specifically? And
yeah, some of the women that I mentioned, and these are older studies. It seems like people may have moved on from this. There are people that talk about ways in which Protestant Reformation and Catholic Reformation policies expanded options for women and limited them. There are people who talk about these things. And people, they disagree. And they attribute the contraction of possibilities and potentials to different things. Not just the church and the church's policies, but to other economic factors and that sort of thing, too. So, yes, it's talked about. It's an interesting topic. And I hope I was very careful to articulate myself very carefully around the issue of what the Protestant Reformation did and did not do for women, because it's a huge issue that has been long debated, and studies have been done that also talk to the ways in which the Protestant Reformation certainly fomented opportunities for women. Okay, women were the helpmeet of their husband, and they had expanded opportunities. But those, according to experts, and I'm not in that particular area. They were case-by-case issues, and people like Mary Wisner are careful to articulate them as cases in point and not general trends. That's a huge question, Miss. Hopefully I've partially outlined some ideas. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Are there any specific scripture verses that helped Teresa to formulate her view of vocation? Scripture verses?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I'll start a little bit more expansively than your question does. Teresa, of the nuns of her age, uses a lot of scripture, and this is unusual because women did not have direct access to the Bible. First of all, the Bible that existed was in Latin, the Vulgate, in Spain, right? It was in Latin. She didn't read Latin. And at that time, all vernacular Bibles had disappeared. They were put on the Inquisition's list of prohibited books in the mid-16th century, 1550-something. Okay, so she didn't have access to a Bible. So whether she articulated herself around the idea of vocation using biblical passages, she was very careful to use biblical affirmation for her ideas. And it's interesting that she does because, again, as I said, she didn't have access to a Bible. She must have heard it from preaching. That's what people surmise. So she articulated herself around all her ideas using biblical texts. What those texts were, I couldn't really tell you. But a lot of them had to do with this idea of obedience to God in life, that sort of thing. And so in a certain sense, the entire paper sort of answers your question because her theology of life, from soup to nuts, from her highest mystical articulations, the ecstasy, the statue I showed you at the beginning of the hour, all the way down to dusting and whatnot, was all articulated within this idea of loving God and neighbor, which is central biblical theology that she got well and linked to vocation. If you read Neil Plantinga or the Jesuit is the person I can't think of his name. Martin, thank you. Ciao. So,
any other questions or comments people want to add? If not at this point, what I'd like us to do then is thank Lisa in a minute, but also announce to you that the Meter Center has a lecture coming up in early April. We will be welcoming Professor Eric de Boer, who's coming to us from the Theological University of Kampen in the Netherlands, and he will be talking about Bible studies in Reformation Geneva. What was it like to be part of a pastor's Bible study in Reformation Geneva? So you don't want to miss that. That should be really, really cool. In the meantime, let us thank Elisa for her.
Thank you, guys.